not know much about the, so-called martial tactics. They are not able to defeat the killers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, so he did not join them. But later, after the uprising of Tawwabin was defeated, he went to the houses of those who lost their dear ones, and he consoled them, and he tried to free some of the people who were in prison. But then, on the 14th of Rabiul Awwal, year 66, he began his uprising. So, what was the motive for Mukhtar? He, at least apparently, mentioned that I'm doing this uprising for revenging the blood of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It's been mentioned that he said, "I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that even if I kill 2/3 of Quraysh, it would not be a retaliation for even one finger of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam." And in his uprising, he killed almost all the main people in the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, including Shaykh ibn al-Dushan, Khuli, Umar ibn Sa'd, Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, and also in some parts of his uprising, Ibrahim Salam Malik al-Ashtar, he helped him.
Yeah.
And finally, we know that he was killed on the 14th of Ramadan, year 67 after Hijra, by Mus'ab ibn Zubayr. Mus'ab did very brutal actions. It's been mentioned that the supporters of Mukhtar, who were about 6,000 people, they were surrounded in his castle. They submitted themselves, but Mus'ab commanded all of them to be killed. And it was very brutal, so much so that Abdullah ibn Umar told Mus'ab that if these were the sheaves of your father, you shouldn't do that. Now you have killed 6,000 Muslims.
Very true.
Not only Mukhtar, his wife Umrah, the daughter of Nu'man ibn Bashir, she was also killed by the army of Mus'ab ibn Zubayr. It's been mentioned that she was the first lady who was beheaded in the history of Islam. Now, that was a very short, summary of his uprising. Now, what is his motivation? What was his relation to Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam? Was he really a true Shia of the Imam?
And some say that he believed in Muhammad Hanafiya to be the leader of the Islamic Ummah and the Imam of the society. And I'd be thankful if you even talk about this issue as well.
Sure.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, the point is that when we so the slogan of Mukhtar was Ya Laparat al-Hussein. So he announced that I'm going to revenge for the blood of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But some people accuse him of misusing this slogan to reach power. When it comes to his relation to Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, again we have contradicting accounts. According to some narrations, Imam rejects some gifts sent to him by Mukhtar, and according to some narrations, Imam accepts the uprising of Mukhtar, but because of the fact that he was not able, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was not able to directly help and guide Mukhtar Thaqafi, he announced that Muhammad ibn Hanafiya is my representative about the uprising of Mukhtar. And that is why Mukhtar did not refer to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam for his uprising, rather he referred to Muhammad bin Hanafiya. According to some narrations, it's been mentioned that, for example, Mukhtar sent 20,000 dinars to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Imam accepted them and he built some houses for some of the Banu Hashim. And according to another account, he sent a slave girl to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and Zayd ibn Ali was born from that slave girl. According to another report, some of the nobles of the city of Kufa, they went to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and asked him about the mission of Mukhtar. And Imam told them that you need to refer to Muhammad bin Hanafiya. Then he told Muhammad bin Hanafiya that even if a slave person wants to help us, the Ahlul Bayt, it is upon the people to help him. Regarding this issue, I'm choosing you as my representative. To do that, to do what you will, you are my representative when it comes to the uprising of Mukhtar Thaqafi. Now, we have different viewpoints among Shia scholars. For example, Ayatollah Khoi and the late Mamaqani, they believe that the uprising of Mukhtar was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. And to put it in a nutshell, we have three viewpoints among Shia scholars in the history up until today. So we do not have one, there is no consensus about the character and the motivation of Mukhtar Thaqafi. The first idea is that he really was searching, his motivation was to revenge for the blood of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and to give power to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. The second idea was that no, he just misused this slogan, he was after power. And the third one is a middle one, which says that yes, he was looking for revenging for Imam Hussein alayhi salam,
but leave the power after that.
Not after that. In some cases, he went to extreme and he did some negative actions, but his motivation was good, but doesn't mean that whatever he did was based on the order of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So we have these three viewpoints, but what are the reasons for each one? I think we need to analyze them in the following.
Very true. Okay, thank you, dear Sheikh. Yes, still we have some questions regarding the characteristics and, let's say, personality of this important figure of the history of Islam, Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. And even there are, Sheikh, some narrations from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam that they actually admired and praised him. And these types of narrations need to be looked at as well, I think, inshallah, in upcoming sessions, if we are going to continue talking about his personality. Dear brothers and sisters, many thanks for staying tuned and listening to us. Q&A, Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. Till our next session, I'll live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روبا شافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا سغلام استنبول
سيد أمين عالمي كابول
شهان بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aid to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to bazaar shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aid. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Subah was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation. Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories. But they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Yusuf has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Yusuf. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security.
During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghani people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it is looking at temporary measures to to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly. Whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
The United States border with Mexico has witnessed an influx of asylum seekers in recent weeks, with thousands, mostly Haitians, massing there after fleeing poverty in their home country. The migrants reached the Rio Grande after a long, treacherous journey. Images showed people with toddlers staying in squalid tents under a bridge in the Texan border town of Del Rio. But as usual, U.S. authorities began removing and expelling and, in some cases, cracking down on refugees despite criticism at home and abroad. On Thursday, U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in a fiery letter over what he called inhumane expulsions of asylum seekers. The United Nations also demanded an end to the mass expulsion, with UN refugee chief calling it inconsistent with international norms. The United Nations Human Rights Office particularly expressed concern over the ill treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border.
Like, we are disturbed by the images we've seen, and by the fact that we've seen all these migrants and refugees and asylum seekers being transported to Port-au-Prince. We are seriously concerned by the fact that it appears that there has not been any individual assessment on the case.
Condemnations poured in after images showing predominantly white federal agents on horseback whipping and chasing migrants went viral on social media. Human rights groups say such incidents are reminiscent of the disturbing U.S. history of racial and ethnic violence.
The United States has been in existence. It has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans.
The Mexican president, whose country has been the main transit for U.S.-bound migrants, called on his American counterpart to deal with the root cause of the migrant problem. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the U.S. to invest in the countries from where migration originates. As the U.S. continues to grapple with the influx of migrants, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration prevents the crisis on its southern border in a humane way or continues breaking its promises to welcome migrants into the country.
Nerves are growing more frayed in the EU ahead of wintertime. Gas prices have soared by 250% since the start of the year, and supplies are depleting. Almost half of all gas used in the EU is imported from Russia, but relations between the bloc and Moscow are at an all-time low. Analysts say it's not surprising, therefore, that the Kremlin is reluctant to increase supplies. The crisis has been discussed at a meeting of EU energy ministers attended by senior European Commission officials.
We have to end our dependence on foreign, volatile fossil fuels as soon as possible. We also need to take energy efficiency seriously.
Experts say ordinary, hard-pressed citizens are now paying the price because the EU refuses to dial down its anti-Russia rhetoric.
It's not possible to expect that European Union will export its rules, its behavior, all its values to everybody in this neighborhood. But it seems to me that the feeling here sometimes in the political bodies of the European Union is the following. If others are not taking the internal rules of the European Union, that does mean that they are wrong, that they are incorrect.
Gas prices have shot up due to demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Millions of energy customers face spiralling price hikes as several smaller firms in the market have collapsed in a matter of days. Avro Energy and Green ceased trading on Wednesday, with existing customers now face being put onto expensive new tariffs, with the energy regulator warning there could be more bad news ahead.
Not unusual for suppliers to go out of the market. I think what's different this time is that dramatic change in the costs that those suppliers are facing. So we've had around sort of, you know, we've had five roughly over the past few months. We've had a number more at the start of the year.
Business Minister Kwasi Kwarteng has already said there will be no bailout for the majority of energy firms, but the government will instead focus on the plight of the customer.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue. We will protect, continue to protect, consumers with the energy price cap.
On the streets of the British capital, there were fears of what a price hike would mean, but also calls for accountability.
It's unacceptable. Everything is going high, even the price of food and everything is going high. Even the public transport, everything is going high. So the government, they should do something about that.
Are you worried that your bills might increase this winter?
Yes, I am. I'm a pensioner. I'm very worried about it.
At some point, there has to be a reason as to why this has happened, whether it could have been foreseen, whether things could have been done to prevent it. The people who run the energy companies, how much money have they made? How much money have they taken off and shipped offshore? That should be looked at.
The British consumer has had a tough couple of months. First of all, dealing with the uncertainty around Brexit, the fallout from the COVID crisis, and now the prospect of spiraling energy costs.
Once more, it will be the most vulnerable who may yet again bear the brunt of any drastic price hikes this winter, with some households having to choose between heating and eating. Amina Taylor, London.
Former Catalan regional leader Carles Puigdemont must stay in Sardinia, Sassari judge ruled on Friday. The politician had been arrested by the Italian police upon his arrival to the Sardinian town of Alghero on Thursday night. Puigdemont had reportedly travelled there to attend a conference, but he was put in custody as soon as he stepped onto Italian soil. He was detained under an international arrest warrant issued by Spain over his alleged involvement in the unilateral independence referendum and the subsequent unilateral declaration of independence of Catalonia 4 years ago. Puigdemont is now a member of the European Parliament living in Belgium. Tens of supporters of the politician demonstrated outside the Sassari court calling for his release.
Later on Friday, former Catalonia president Puigdemont
was released by a local court, but the politician will have to remain in Sardinia until questions such the validity of the European arrest warrant against him and his immunity status are resolved. Should the arrest be considered valid, the same court will have to decide whether to hand him over to Spanish authorities.
Italy's Justice Ministry, on its side, has made clear it had played no role in the case, which, quote, was the sole preserve of the judges involved. Max Civili, Rome.
Islamic and national factions in the Gaza Strip held a protest in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are under hunger strike and are subjected to Israeli abuse. The event that included Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross headquarters came a day after an ex-prisoner, Hussein Masalma, died of cancer after being detained for 19 years.
We are here in front of the Red Cross to remind the international human rights organizations of their role to protect our prisoners inside Israeli jails and who are under solitary confinement. There are six prisoners under hunger strike protesting the inhumane Israeli abuse against them and the illegal administrative detention. This is not the only medical negligence of hundreds of our prisoners, but an international killing practiced by the Israeli regime.
Al-Masalma's medical condition deteriorated due to complications resulting from Israeli medical negligence and torture at the time he was in custody that led to his inevitable slow death.
There is no doubt that Palestinian detainees are witnessing tough measures and abuse inside the Israeli jails, especially following the escape operation. Yesterday, Al-Masalma succumbed to his cancer that deteriorated while being in jail. There are more than hundreds of inmates who have lost their lives in Israeli jails due to intentional medical negligence.
Palestinian factions say they won't sit idle while Israeli violations against the prisoners are increasing, urging the international community to take serious action to save the prisoners' life.
We are holding Friday prayer here in front of the Red Cross to express our support to our prisoners who are a symbol of our Palestinian cause. We will always be proud of their patience. Our message to the Israeli regime is clear. We hold Israel responsible for the lives of our prisoners and we won't remain silent over these violations.
Palestinian detainees are passing through hard medical conditions as 15 inmates inside Israeli jails are diagnosed with cancer, while more than 200 others have lost their lives as a result of the Israeli systematic policy of medical negligence.
While hundreds of Palestinian detainees, including women and children, are subjected to inhumane violations of their rights inside Israeli jails, Palestinians here are paying efforts demanding the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue. Roba Shabit, Gaza.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Senate Republicans on Monday, 27th of September, blocked a spending bill needed to avert a government shutdown this week and a federal debt default next month, moving the nation closer to the brink of fiscal crisis as they refused to allow Democrats to lift the limit on federal borrowing. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Emily Cottrain and Katie Edmondson. The piece is titled, Republicans Block Government Funding, Refusing to Lift Debt Limit. Republicans on Monday, 27th of September, blocked a spending bill needed to avert a government shutdown this week and a federal debt default next month, moving the nation closer to the brink of fiscal crisis as they refused to allow Democrats to lift the limit on federal borrowing. With a Thursday, 30th of September deadline looming to fund the government and a country moving closer to a catastrophic debt limit breach, the stalemate in the Senate reflected a bid by Republicans to undercut President Biden and top Democrats at a critical moment, as they labor to keep the government running and enact an ambitious domestic agenda. Republicans, who had voted to raise the debt cap by trillions when their party controlled Washington, argued on Monday that Democrats must shoulder the entire political burden for doing so now, given that they control the White House and both houses of Congress. Their position was calculated to portray Democrats as ineffectual and overreaching at a time when they are already toiling to iron out deep party divisions over a $3.5 trillion social safety net and climate change bill, and to pave the way for a bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure measure whose fate is linked to it. The package that was blocked on Monday, which also included emergency aid to support the resettlement of Afghan refugees and disaster recovery, would keep all government agencies funded through to 3rd of December and increase the debt ceiling through the end of 2022. But after the bill cleared the House a week earlier with just Democratic votes, it fell far short of the 60 votes needed to move forward in the Senate on Monday. The vote was 48-50 to advance the measure. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader, was among those voting no, a procedural maneuver to allow the bill to be reconsidered at some point. But there were no immediate details about next steps. The resulting cloud of fiscal uncertainty marked yet another challenge for President Biden and Democratic leaders, while facing a daunting set of tasks as they press to keep the government funded. Scrounge together the votes for the infrastructure bill, also slated for a vote on Thursday, 30th of September, and resolve their disputes over the broader budget plan. They must also hatch a new strategy for raising the statutory limit on federal borrowing, which officials have said is on track to be reached as early as mid to late October. It may not be by the end of the week. I hope it's by the end of the week, President Biden said on Monday at the White House, referring to the outlook for accomplishing all of the imperatives Congress now faces. Ticking off the four pieces of legislation, he added, "We do that, the country is going to be in a great shape." Without any of them, President Biden's agenda and his party's fortunes would be in peril, a prospect that Republicans appear to relish. Although both political parties willingly racked up trillions of dollars in debt in recent years, Senate Republicans presented their refusal to vote for the debt cap increase on Monday as deserved comeuppance for Democrats who are pushing past GOP opposition to muscle their multi-trillion dollar domestic spending and tax increase plan through Congress. We will not provide Republican votes for raising the debt limit, said Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, repeating a warning he has issued for months. Mitch McConnell added, "Bipartisanship is not a light switch that Democrats get to flip on when they need to borrow money and switch off when they want to spend money. The debt ceiling increase is needed to finance borrowing that occurred in the past under administrations of both parties, not to pay for plans that President Biden has yet to sign into law. And so far, there is little outreach or negotiation to resolve the impasse. Still, Senator Mitch McConnell sought to frame the vote as a test of Democrats' competence, as he and other Republicans vowed to support a nearly identical temporary spending package without an increase in the debt ceiling. We'll see if Washington Democrats actually want to govern, Senator McConnell said. Democrats rejected that alternative, accusing Republicans of recklessly jeopardizing the country's full faith and credit. Senator Chuck Schumer said the vote meant the Republican Party has now become the party of default, the party that says America doesn't pay its debts. That isn't your typical Washington fracas, he said, adding, it's one of the most reckless, one of the most irresponsible votes I have seen taken place in the Senate. Even as the spending measure fell short, Democratic leaders worked to unite their caucus behind the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Moderate Democrats have agitated for a vote this week on that legislation, while liberal Democrats have warned they will oppose it without action first on the $3.5 trillion social policy and economic package. The two bills are linked, said Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota and a progressive, and they have to be linked in order for anything to pass the House. Amid the looming deadline, Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California spoke with Senator Chuck Schumer and President Joe Biden on Monday, according to a White House summary. Later, Nancy Pelosi huddled privately with Democrats to try to break through the impasse in Congress, signaling that the House would move forward with the $1 trillion infrastructure bill before the social policy package was fully negotiated. It isn't about diminishing the importance of the reconciliation, Nancy Pelosi told members of her caucus, according to a person who disclosed the remarks on condition of anonymity. She went on to say that lawmakers could not insist on waiting to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill as negotiations continued with the Senate over the reconciliation package. Yet, as of Monday evening, it was still unclear how congressional leaders would handle the urgent legislation to keep the government running. White House officials and Democratic congressional leaders have ramped up a drumbeat of warnings in recent weeks about the economic toll of delaying a vote on the debt ceiling.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero
or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام لا تظنن بكلمة خرجت من أحد سوءا وأنت تجد لها في الخير محتملا.
Imam Ali said, "Do not regard an expression uttered by any person as evil if you can find it capable of bearing some good." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. In the historical texts, dear friends, we find this very beautiful and interesting report from a man named Wahidi. In this report, he says that Imam Ali, Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Prophet, and Talha, one of the companions of the Holy Prophet and the companions of Imam Ali, were engaged in this kind of self-glorification or in this talk of pride about each other's accomplishments. And so originally the conversation goes that Talha and Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Prophet, the two of them were talking to each other about what made them better or made them more important than the other. It is after the two of these, Talha and Abbas, were speaking to each other that in the end Imam Ali comes and he speaks as well. So Talha, he says, "What a better honor is there for me than having the keys of Allah's house and its opening upon my orders." So Talha here, he was saying that he has the keys of the Kaaba, the house of Allah, and it opens and closes upon his order. So Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Prophet, says, "It is an honor for me that I provide the Hajj pilgrims with the water of Zamzam, which is solely at my disposal." And so the water of Zamzam was under the honor of Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Prophet, to give this water to the Hajj pilgrims. Now the two of these were talking to each other, and then Imam Ali says, "I have no idea of what you are both speaking about, but I started to worship Allah 6 months before any other person." So here Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about being the first man to accept Islam, and it was only after 6 months of him accepting Islam did any other man accept Islam. And so this is something which is recorded in both the Sunni books and the Shia books, that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the first man. He was the exactly the first man to accept Islam at the proclamation of the Holy Prophet. And so here, dear friends, the subtle point and the lesson is that these different honors which a human being has, these aren't as important. The status, the power, the position, this is not what gives value and true honor to a human being. True value, true honor, true status, true position, true greatness comes via belief. It comes via faith. It comes via iman. And so just as Imam Ali alayhi salam says that being a believer, being a worshiper of Allah before the other people is a pride and an honor, thus it should be for us as well. Interestingly, this same conversation that takes place is reflected in the Holy Quran in chapter number 9, verse number 19 through 20. So go ahead and check it out. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, remember, the best out of these pieces of advice of mine are those which tell you to fear Allah, to concentrate and to confine yourself to the performance of those duties which have been made incumbent upon you by Him, and to follow in the footsteps of your ancestors, the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali, and your pious and virtuous relationship. Verily, they always carefully measured their thoughts and deeds, as you must also try to do, and they carefully thought over the subject before saying anything about it or before doing a deed. You should also follow the same. This kind of deliberation made them take from life what was really the best and forsake that which was not made incumbent upon them, or which was not the best. If your mind refuses to accept my advice and you persist to try your own experiments like them, then you are at liberty to arrive at your conclusions, but only after thoroughly studying the subject and after acquiring the knowledge necessary for such decisions.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. And I would like to begin with this very question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali. There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. Look at the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Fussilat, ayat number 42, he says, لَا يَأْتِيهِ الْبَاطِلِ مِنْ بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ وَلَا مِنْ خَلْفِهِ. Quran is a protected book. No falsehood will come to it from the front or the back or any direction. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah An-Nahl, ayat number 82 says, وَنَزَّلْنَا عَلَيْكَ الْكِتَابِ تِبِيَانًا لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ. Quran is tibyan, clarification for everything. Aliyun ma'al Quran wal Quran ma'a Aliyin. Basically means the way Quran has been protected from falsehood and batil, the person of Ali bin Abi Talib has been protected from every falsehood and batil. Quran is ma'asum and Ali is also ma'asum and protected. Quran is tibyanan li kulli shay. Quran is clarification for everything. And Ali is the source of tibyan for everything. In that ayat, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, tibyanan li kulli shay wa hudan wa rahmatan wa bushra lil muslimin. That Quran is not only a tibyan, it is a guidance and mercy and good news for the Muslims. Ali ibn Abi Talib similarly is huda. He is the guidance and he is the rahmah and he is the bushra and the good news for the mu'mineen.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.